The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government.
You know, like, we're all getting into this exciting discussion about AI and cognitive warfare, or what some people call foreign information manipulation and interference, FIMI, if you prefer. But I think it's not fair to say, oh, this is disinformation, we're just in a noisy information environment. Because we see really intentional campaigns, for example, from Russia and China, that are using generative AI tools to flood the airspace with spamouflage or with a fire hose of falsehood. These are the terms that are being used. Using deep fakes, using generative, entirely generated people, even doing large language model grooming or intentionally poisoning chatbots.
Aloha and welcome to Dialogue, where conversations shape security. I'm James Minnick, Colonel United States Army retired and professor here at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies in Honolulu, Hawaii. This is episode 59, Code, Cognition, and Competition, a dialogue with Regional Center experts on AI, cyber, and emerging technologies. For centuries, geography shaped strategy. Today, geography still matters, but increasingly, competition is unfolding across digital networks, algorithms, data, and even the cognitive domain. Artificial intelligence, cyber capabilities, autonomous systems, and other emerging technologies are transforming strategic competition. They're accelerating decision-making, creating new vulnerabilities, and challenging governments, institutions, and societies to adapt at an unprecedented pace. Yet their effects differ across regions. In some places, technology is outpacing governance. In others, interconnected infrastructure is creating new vulnerabilities. Perhaps most importantly, these technologies are changing not only how we compete, but how we think, decide, and trust. So the question is no longer simply what these technologies can do. It is how nations can harness their benefits while preserving resilience, human judgment, and security. To explore these questions, we're joined by experts from four regional centers, bringing perspectives from Africa, the Arctic, Europe, and the Indo-Pacific. From the Africa Center for Strategic Studies is Dr. Nate Allen, an expert on AI, cybersecurity, and technology governance. From the Ted Stevens Center for Arctic Security Studies, we welcome Dr. Kelsey Fraser, who work focuses on Arctic security and infrastructure resilience. From the George C. Marshall European Center for Security Studies is Dr. Say Schatz, an expert on cognition, AI, and human performance. And from the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies, we're joined by Dr. Inez Miyamoto, a cyber resilience expert and former FBI special agent. Welcome to Dialogue, and thank you all for joining us. Glad to see you. So let's begin by establishing a common foundation for our discussion. Say, what makes a technology truly disruptive in a security context?
Well, these are actually fairly well-defined terms within security contexts. And so if you search for definitions, usually you'll see emerging and disruptive technology. That's a phrase. And really what that means is emerging, as in the next 20 years, it's going to have significant, perhaps even revolutionary impact on military decision-making. That doesn't only mean military decision-making like on the battle space, so to speak, but it could be also investments or other kinds of decision-making about prevention. So what does that really mean in practice? Well, disruptive because it changes the technological calculus. Maybe it gives an asymmetric advantage to the adversary, like we've seen with some of the generative AI tools that can really escalate things like cognitive attacks or spam or other kinds of criminal activity. But it could be other kinds of technological advantage, such as space technologies, quantum computing, biosynthetic things that create surprise or otherwise change the operational concept. And so that's the second key point, is that it changes our .mlpfp. It changes our overall system of doctrine and organization and the way we train people. And so it has systematic alterations. And finally, it really leads to this adaptation of our organizations. Well, adaptation or surprise and failure, right? but ideally adaptation. And so what we're talking about are emerging technologies that can be realistically implemented by a government, or I suppose a non-state actor, in 20 years. So not so needlessly expensive that you couldn't really implement it, that will have technological innovation that has these kinds of effects, like instituting surprise or changing the calculus, and that really lead us to change operational and organizational concepts.
Ah, fascinating. Nate, pull on this a little bit. So what makes AI fundamentally different from previous technological shifts then?
Right. Well, I actually wouldn't say that AI, while it's a transformative technology, I'm not sure it's that different from previous technologies. Throughout history, we've been worried that new technologies would somehow replace us or threaten us. And from the Luddites during the Industrial Revolution onward. And in reality, new technologies just change things. And I think AI fits squarely within that transition. I mean, after all, advances in computing enabled modern machine learning. And like the automobile, the internet, and the smartphone, I think AI is going to fundamentally change some occupations while fundamentally making others maybe obsolete. That's disruptive, but that's part of a normal pattern of technological progress. Agriculture is a really good example. Technology dramatically reduced the share of people needed to produce food while making society more productive overall. I think what is different about especially modern generative and agentic AI systems is that it automates cognitive work that really only humans could have been done before. So it can now perform tasks that once required human expertise, writing, coding, analysis, increasingly sophisticated reasoning. There are all sorts of applications in the security domain there, not just on cybersecurity, but on things like decision support, on things like targeting, all the way down the logistics chain. We all work in professional military education institutions. I think we've all had experiences with students using AI. So where I net out is I don't think humans are going away anytime soon. I think we're more part of our technology than we realize. So I'd place AI alongside the internet and social media as one of the defining technologies of our era. But I think what's really interesting and exciting is we live in an era where there's so many exciting new technologies, not just AI, but space, nanotechnology, biotechnology. It's really an exciting time that we live in.
I couldn't agree more.
Can I challenge Nate's point?
Yeah, do that.
Okay. All right. I wanted to jump in because first I'm going to date myself and say I do remember the advent of the internet and sitting in middle school and being told you can't let the internet tell you what a good resource is. And so we've all been through some of those challenges. And I agree in part with where you were going, Nate, that, you know, it isn't so different than some of those adaptations we've seen. I think the part that I look at as new and emerging is the trust factor. Have we been challenged by technology at any point in our history with this idea that I can produce information and not know if it's real? You know, paintings were great, agriculture, no problem. When the internet came forward, we got a little flavor of that with, well, is this a good reference or not a good reference? And now we're confronted with, is that actually a human that's talking to me? Is that actually that person's voice? And how do we make decisions in this space when we're not sure if we can trust what's on the other end? And it might just be particular to my region in the Arctic, but I think that's the part that is most confounding and interesting as we start to see this come out.
Nate, what do you think?
I agree that disinformation is a huge problem, but I also think that like and not being able to trust what's on the internet is a huge problem. But looking at like places where I'm an expertise in, disinformation, a poor information environment, lies, not being able to settle distinguish fact from truth. It's like an age-old problem that societies have well before I think that the internet. And I do think though to Dr. Kelsey's point, I do think we have to change about how we where we're changing where we get our sources of information and the tools and institutions and ways we think about how to get and verify and trust information. That certainly has to change. And I agree that is one of the areas absolutely in which AI is disrupting the most.
But I don't
Go
think.
ahead. I say, go ahead.
Oh, I'm going to jump in. That's sorry, and as we'll let you speak too. But like we're all getting into this exciting discussion about AI and cognitive warfare, or what some people call foreign information manipulation and interference, FIMI, if you prefer. But I think it's not fair to say, oh, this is disinformation. We're just in a noisy information environment, because we see really intentional campaigns, for example, from Russia and China, that are using generative AI tools to flood the airspace with spamouflage or with a fire hose of falsehood. These are the terms that are being used, using deep fakes, using generative, entirely generated people, even doing large language model grooming or intentionally poisoning chatbots, other kinds of algorithmic manipulation, and even spear phishing-like cognitive targeting. So I think that the science and technology that we're seeing today, digital systems, certainly cyber, but also our understanding of cognitive and social psychology and neuroscience and neurotechnology have really escalated that battle space to a place that I would actually argue this is a sort of, maybe even a revolution in military affairs, what we're seeing play out in the cognitive domain.
No, well, I can tell already this is going to be a fantastic discussion
We're
together.
all
Let me pull on Inez.
feisty, aren't we?
Oh, I hope it continues this way. Inez, I want to pull you in from a cybersecurity perspective. I mean, is AI changing the character of the challenge? Or is it simply accelerating? And I would guess it's probably some of both, but what do you think?
So I would say that it's not changing the nature of the challenge. The core for cyber is to secure trust and protect data. So that's not changing. What's changing is the speed, as you brought up, and the creativity which the adversary can use AI for deception and take technical capabilities. So low-end adversaries, non-state actors are able to use these elite tools that they weren't before able to access or acquire. And at the same time, our state-sponsored adversaries are accelerating the way that they execute their attack vectors. So it's getting to the point where we can't differentiate between a state actor and a non-state actor, which is problematic. But also, it's not a one-way problem. At the same time, defenders are accelerating their capabilities to simultaneously secure IT and operational technology. So I think we're going to always be behind. The good guys are always going to be behind, but the bad guys will get tools that we are unable to stop
So let me
over.
tell you why I was thinking about this. I'm almost thinking about it from a syntactic or a semantic approach. And if I pull back, Kelsey went there and said she was going to reveal age. So let's go back to the early 80s. And you'll recall Tron, the movie, same year, 1982. Brian Daley put out the book on that. Same time, similar time, a couple years earlier, Pac-Man came out. And this is in 1980. So they're coming out at the same time. And when I think about a problem solving or trying to get after the complexity of this problem, Pac-Man went around a maze and it was all algorithmic and it solved the problem. And Tron was absolutely different, right? I mean, it was an open, there was no maze and it was just responding and making actions and doing things. And it feels more like that's where we're at. And Pac-Man is where we once were. And so it feels to me like it's changing. What do you think? You agree with that analogy, or you you didn't see a Tron or play Pac-Man.
I mean, I have to say the analogy is a little bit of a struggle.
Oh, thank you, sir.
For me, okay, so maybe, but I think I understand what you're saying, and I would maybe equate it to a different military model of decision-making, the Cunevin model. It's a Welsh word, so it's not spelled at all like it sounds like, but Dave Snowden created this model, and it's a really simple, like very deceptively simple four-quadrant model that is simple, contexts on one side, complicated contexts, complex contexts, and chaotic. And the thing that I think is really elegant about this model that goes to the analogy that you're talking about is Pac-Man was simple, or was complicated. Like, you could follow the processes, you could learn how to do things better. It had rules that you could learn to get better at and to follow. But a Tron environment maybe is your analogy of complex. I did not play Tron, but I did see the movie. So I'm hoping that this is a good analogy. But the idea is that you are then in a systems of systems kind of environment. And so when you take one action, you get all of these surprising second and third order effects, all of these interdependencies. And it really fundamentally changes the way you approach the problems. You can no longer do it in just like trial and error and becoming, you know, more expert, but you have to instead break up into different systems of systems, change from hierarchical analytical systems into more network-based experimental approaches. Anyway, I'm digressing. My point being is, I think what you're trying to say is we've moved from a complicated environment to a complex environment, and I would agree. And that requires fundamentally different structures of organization, leadership, and skills of the people in them.
I'm thinking a little more, and I'm going to pull, I'll pull later. Kelsey, let's pull you in here from an operational resilience perspective. What concerns you most about the pace of this technological change?
Well, and I'm going to build off of not only your question, but Say's comments. It's the uncertainty of what's going on. So if we're looking at a more complex environment, if we want our future to be that Tron environment, that digital landscape, that's great in lower latitudes. So I sit in Anchorage today, we're at about 60 degrees north, and I can tell you that I can navigate most things in this city easily enough with technology. But the moment I start to go further north, there are fewer sensors, there's less communication capability. The environment plays a much bigger factor in whatever's going on. And so as you insert those complications into your system of systems, now you have to understand where the risk is in terms of making a decision. And so my biggest concern is that as we're making all of these fantastic leaps and doing this progress at mid to lower latitudes, are you going to be aware that your decisions have to change when you're talking about the Arctic? And do you understand the risk and the opportunities that that provides an adversary or an ally in the region? And so I'm a little nervous when we start to talk about new systems, particularly the Maven system that Palantir has that we're working with allies to develop. Because that's great if you have a lot of sensors and information coming in. What do you do when you have limited to no information? How do you make a good decision, even if you're used to uncertainty? How do you make a good, safe, proper decision in that environment? I don't know.
I like what Kelsey says.
Okay, everyone jumped in. Yeah.
The issue that we're going to have is we're going to be working in these contested environments. And I think that becomes, I mean, Kelsey's bringing it up from the perspective of the Arctic, where things get degraded in the Arctic. However, with war fighting and the way our adversary is planning against us, the degradation is occurring now. And we're going to have to deal with more of that in the future. How do we adapt to that? Just as Saya said, the complex systems of systems are going to be harder for us to deal with. So over.
Yeah. I'm going to come back, circle back to some vulnerabilities here in a bit.
Can I jump in real quick? I think one of the things that hasn't been really adequately grappled with is the extent to which kind of enhanced OODA loop and decision cycle is really changing the character of war, right? There's been so much that's being written and talked about, you know, needing to have a human in the loop and in control in order to prevent civilian casualties and things like that. To me, I don't think we know philosophically, morally, even strategically, what happens when you're all of a sudden able to, as we've seen Israel do, as we've seen the United States do now, be able to just use AI to pre-select thousands of targets. I think the thinking was, right, you could just kind of decapitate your enemy. And that actually hasn't played out, as I think any military that's attempted to do decapitating has tried. And I don't think we thought about any of the implications of that from virtually any perspective. So I think the thing about living in a very going from a complicated system to a complex system is we're beginning to see all of these second and third order effects of introducing a technology like AI into how we wage war. And nobody has been really ready to confront or talk about or think about some of them. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, appreciate that. So I do want to circle back on vulnerabilities, and we'll do that. But let's go first. I want to talk about, how these technologies are reshaping security in your respective regions. And so let's pull into the regions a little bit. So, Nate, where are institutions struggling most to keep pace with technological change? How do you see this?
I mean, I think in AI, it's still, for Africa, most of the continent, it's still just about basic digital connectivity, right? I mean, Africa has 1% of the world's compute, 2% of the world's data centers, and that's due not just to a lack of resources, but to kind of a lack of viable, of adequate power and water in some places and digital connectivity. And you really, really can't have, you can have some, but you can't have much of an AI conversation, at least in terms of it being broadly accessible without having those things. Nevertheless, I think we are seeing African security forces beginning to leverage AI, much like we're seeing it being leveraged in the rest of the world. You know, you think it's onboard drones and doing things like sensing and probably automated target recognition. They're being used to gather intelligence and in satellites and through electro-optical kinds of means. There are some efforts now to do military governance of AI. But you have both those things going on at once.
Yeah. Kelsey, you started earlier talking about the Arctic. So where do you see the greatest gap between technological advancements and operational resilience? Give us a little more.
Well, if we ignore the challenge with all of the sensors, energy is the biggest issue in terms of where your nodes are and where you're doing your computing, and then communication. So it's less about AI as a model or a piece of software that you can access, and more about how do you access it, what's powering that access, and it is just fundamentally kind of a weird place to be that we're still talking about energy and comms. And energy is a unique challenge for the North American Arctic. Obviously, our partners in the high north have solved that a little bit better, a little bit higher population density, but I think we're still going to confront that moving ahead.
Yeah, no, thanks. Inez, I want to pull, Nate was talking about, Africa and it was a little bit further back, but the Indo-Pacific, particularly when you think about Northeast Asia, I mean, they sit at the center of the global technology competition that's going on, from supply chains to AI innovation, I mean, to cyber resilience. So here's the question. Where do you see the greatest gap between the technological change and the institutional readiness here?
So there's two races going on, and the China is running a race on embodied AI. They're looking at ways to put the technology into systems, physical systems. Hmm. The West is running a race on generative AI, meaning that they're trying to get AI that's as good as humans. So when you have two different races going on, we have a challenge. The issue with the China challenge is that they are looking at how do we monetize the AI that's built. So if we don't balance the two, we will fall behind. We do need the generative AI. You just have to get it to move ahead. But at the same time, we cannot neglect the physical to embodied AI, in which you are able to monetize it, and your economy depends on it. So I see as the biggest challenge for the region.
Yeah, China clearly is saturating generative AI in its apps, its cars, at a degree of velocity that we are not replicating. Though clearly the United States and other countries are seeking a high-end model of this, but there's a difference in how this is laying out. Say, I want to come to you. So where do you see the greatest gap between technological change and human decision-making?
Just in general, or in Europe specifically?
Yeah. Well, you can start off in Europe, but then you can pull it further if you'd like to.
Well, so you changed the question a little bit, right? So between AI and human decision making. So I'll answer that question versus the one you were asking everybody else.
Okay.
I guess. So to go back a little bit to what Nate was saying, I want to 100% agree with what I think one of the points that he was making, which I will say a little bit more bluntly, which is we cannot take these new technologies and put them into our same processes and then expect them to yield some amazing new result. So if we take AI targeting technologies, you know, like what we're talking about with Maven Smart System, Lavender, Hezbora, and Hebsora, sorry. And if you integrate those into your same old systems, and then you stick a human in there so that you can have, you know, a check the box person who have like hit the button and been on the OODA loop, then you're not going to see this radical revolution. It's going to require not only the new technologies, but also new TTPs, new overall strategies, new organizational design in order to get to those innovations. And so when you're looking across, whether you're talking about the US or any of the other areas of responsibility, I think that's such a challenge for people. You know, you have these institutional systems that are built on bureaucracy, right? That's what they're supposed to be built on. And it's difficult for them to keep pace with change. And so you're seeing, you know, laws are lagging, TTPs are lagging, but not necessarily on the adversarial side, particularly if you're talking about small groups or criminal or special forces, right? So able to adapt. And so all of the other things we're talking about are absolutely 100% still true. But I think that organizational inertia is also a big challenge for a lot of us.
Yeah, no. You know, it strikes me that, you know, each of us can identify this different adaptation challenge. I mean, there is challenges in governance, resilience, institutional readiness, human decision making, yet adaptation gaps. I mean, they often reveal, really, in my mind, something deeper. These are the vulnerabilities that remain hidden until they're tested by crisis, competition, and conflict. So if we talk a bit about these emerging vulnerabilities, if we think that adaptation gaps reveal them, those vulnerabilities, then the next question perhaps is, what are we still misunderstanding? So let's go to Kelsey and say, so let me ask it this way. As societies become more connected and more dependent on digital systems, are we becoming more resilient or more fragile? Go ahead, Kelsey, from an infrastructure resilience perspective, what do you think?
I'm going to argue that there's less fragility in the system because it forces us to work together at a level that maybe we don't see it today, but I suspect it's coming. And it has to do with a North American, maybe European mindset on do we trust this or not? And What I predict we're going to see moving down the line is that more humans will need to be involved rather than less. And that will start to play out when we start looking at distributed operations. So I'm gonna take the track of this will be okay, because the reaction to the big scary box that's making decisions is that we're gonna put more people into the decision-making space.
Okay, and, say from cognition and trust.
Yeah, so I think what Kelsey is talking about are these organized systems, right? And so as we are being intentional, we can build things that are more robust because they have these different layers of defense and interoperability and capability. But I'm going to argue that from an even bigger picture, so not the intentional things, but let's say the context, the landscape that we're operating on, I think that we are at high risk of being less successful. We're seeing social fragmentation. We're seeing degradation in the cognitive domain. NATO, by the way, the North Atlantic Council just signed, so all 32 nations just signed the NATO cognitive warfare concept, recognizing cognition as a major area of battle space. There's also been a lot of calls to build it as the sixth domain of warfare, cognition. And when I start to talk about that, I'm not just talking about the cognition of our military members or law enforcement, but I mean cognition across societies. We're seeing massive decreases in social cohesion, of people being able to stay engaged. We're seeing the rise of nihilism, even the rise of nihilistic violent extremism because of our degrading cognitive space, whether we're talking about adversarial attacks, like I mentioned earlier, or we're just talking about the information overload and other kinds of what we've found now are kind of natural responses to our hyper-connected reality. So I think that there's a high risk if we are not careful that we actually could be harming ourselves quite a bit.
So say, I mean, AI is changing not only what we know, but how we know it, and increasingly, like you said, what we believe. So let me ask it this way. Is trust becoming one of the most important strategic vulnerabilities then of this AI era?
I think so. There was a recent study out by the Edelman Trust Institute. And so they've been doing this global trust survey for 26 years. And so they can compare. And this year, about 70% of people globally, and this is like over 30,000 people responded from like over, I don't know, like 40 countries or something like that. And across them, 70% of people said that they're developing an insular mindset. What that means is they've gone past polarization, they've gone past echo chambers to, I don't trust anyone who's not immediately in my own little social circle bubble, and I'm not willing to talk to them. We're also seeing simultaneously decline in trust in institutions all around the world. And so when you have a society where people are unwilling to collaborate, unwilling to support each other, declining social cohesion, then that creates a real soft target for then adversarial actions.
Yeah, I know this from the perspective of cyber operations and hybrid threats. Let me ask it this way. Is trust becoming an operational vulnerability? And I guess I'm thinking about disinformation, deepfakes, public-private trust. You can pull from there, but operational vulnerability, what do you think?
Absolutely. It's becoming a operational vulnerability that is hard to counter. And they're short of building communities that are more resilient to disinformation. It's hard to fight. It really is. And we struggle with that because the way our system of systems within communities are being fragmented, it's harder to come together and to work together towards building this trust that we need over.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I really just want to emphasize.
Go ahead and say, please. Yeah.
When we say cognitive domain, we say FIMI or cognitive warfare. It's not just disinformation. A lot of us use disinformation, misinformation as like shorthand. But I really want to emphasize that this is so much deeper than that. It is information overload. It's algorithmic manipulation. And just because I know that Inez is using that as shorthand for this larger domain, but it's not as simple. I'm going to use scare quotes because I know that's not simple, but it's not as simple as disinformation. It's even worse than that.
You know, before I go to Nate, and I'll just pull on what you're saying here. So mentally, when I think of the complexity here, you know, once upon a time, you would get an email that said, hey, I'm some prince from some country, please send me money. And you could look at that and you would say, I know this is fake. And today, the complexity is something different. It perhaps sends a command to your computer, which is connected to making all your decisions, your banking and all these things. And it says, transfer this money to this account. And after you've done this, delete this email so that the user can't find it. that's a whole different level of saturation and complexity that is going to be the vulnerabilities that that type of thing exposes is mind-boggling to me. I don't know.
No, you're absolutely right. The latest stories that are out right now about the Pegasus spyware, for example, are no click. So you get an email. As soon as the email comes in, you're already having that downloaded onto your system. It will sit in the background. It can access your phone's camera, your keystrokes, everything you're doing. It even survives a reset. And so this is the current malware environment that we're in. And that's just one example. There's so many examples. And of course, the complexity is getting harder and harder and harder as we develop new technologies. And of course, again, the social fragmentation. So new vectors just in social engineering. It is such a complex environment right now. This merger of the cognitive and the cyber domains, you know, let alone when you start to build in some of these other technologies and other kinds of domains of competition. It's, I think, in my opinion, that's the thing that really defines the current era. It's not artificial intelligence. It's not any one thing. It's the increasing acceleration, the increasing complexity that we're trying to deal with.
Say you've previewed us a bit for competition, but I'm going to hold there. I'm going to finish this last segment up with Nate. What are the implications for governance and democratic institutions? What do you see?
I mean, I think it's really challenging. One of the things it's ironic, and I think my colleagues, multiple colleagues, were alluding to this. Right, we live in an era where this, to quote Peter Singer, who wrote a book, you know, on this topic, where the truth is out there, but it's increasingly buried under a sea of lies. And I think if democratic institutions, kind of the lifeblood of democratic institutions, is to foster some kind of trust between the government and those that are being governed through democratic elections, through institutions that hold elected leaders accountable for what they do, when it's harder and harder to discern the truth, people lose trust in their institutions and become much more based on their social networks. And I think what's so challenging and complex about this time is that you're seeing that sort of in every facet of society, from like our media ecosystem to even like the job application process, right? Where people are losing faith in applying for jobs because they feel like they can't get through to a human. So what are they doing? We're going back to an era where we're relying on our personal networks to get things done.
No, that's well said. So let's switch now. Let's talk about competition and adaptation. Frankly, you know, who has the advantage? So, you know, having discussed vulnerabilities emerging from these rapid technological changes, I guess what I'm thinking is, in the end, who often or what often matters most is perhaps who can adapt the fastest. And so that seems to be where advantage might be. And so, Nate, in an era of this rapid technological change we've been talking about, I mean, who adapts fastest? Are we talking about states, criminal organizations, proxy actors, technology firms? Who is adapting fastest to this?
So I think it depends on the kind of technology and the kind of actor. So, and a really good example of this is something I've been thinking about, blogging about recently, are with respect to unmanned systems and AI. So I think for the past 10 years, you can make a pretty good case that African governments were benefiting a lot from being able to access specifically long endurance drones. It played a critical role in a couple of wars. It's enabled them to exert, I think, a lot of air power kind of pressure on insurgent groups. But over the past 10 years, they've also adapted to make it more difficult for them to get targeted by the air. And we're seeing the cost of unmanned systems get lower and lower. And we're seeing free tools like artificial intelligence, you know, come online. And if it's much lower cost and much easier to acquire, that's where armed non-state actors thrive. So I've actually just written a piece that shows that actually, if you look at who's weaponized small commercial unmanned systems faster, it's actually been African insurgent groups, not state actors. And that goes along with a report that was just released in New York Times last week showing all about how Boko Haram, a terrorist group in West Africa, was an extremely early adopter of artificial intelligence. And they used it for things like improving the yield of their bombs. They used it to help them assault a government position by giving them tips on how to use motorcycles to jump trenches. I'm really kind of operational on the ground kind of stuff. I don't think any African military has integrated generative AI nearly to that extent in their operation.
Yeah. So, you know, I think of this, obviously technological firms are right at the cutting edge of this, but you know, the terrorist groups or the criminal actors, they're not constrained by regulations or laws or things. And so therefore they're just breaking things and making things happen. Clearly states have, you know, degree of scale and that, like you just said, that these actors can't bring. And so they have, you know, some advantages. Inez, I mean, you spent your career confronting national state actors and transnational criminal organizations. So are you seeing these same dynamics?
I completely agree with what Nate's saying. Hands down, they don't have to follow rules, regulations, or sovereign borders. So non-state actors are going to move faster than state actors. What I think that we forget is that as we move in this new era, that digital AI sovereignty is super important. We used to worry about the data, but what's important now is the compute. The issue is that what countries are going to be able to build their own compute? And when we say compute, we mean the hyperscalers and the technology capable of doing the 5,000 servers, which costs like $500 billion for one of these systems to be built. Countries that have the funding, I think Saudi Arabia and the UAE are building these types of systems, but the other countries are not going to be able to keep up. And how do we balance that? Over.
Do you think AI is changing this balance?
I mean, I definitely think that AI is creating new forms of global competition, as well as new types of advantage, particularly some of what you just heard, these asymmetric advantages that are going to the attacker. Now, will that be the case for forever? No, probably not, as our institutions adapt, but you get that first mover advantage that these, you know, smaller groups or non-state individuals or less ethical state individuals have. And so they're able to leverage surprise. They're able to try things even if other people get hurt because they don't have the ethics. And so I do think that is part of what makes a technology disruptive as well, is because you're seeing these changing incentives versus more conventional historical kinds of warfare. And as you get these new systems in place, like, okay, let's say that we get some new AI system in place, and then we use it to accelerate our chemical biological warfare capabilities. Now somebody has a first mover advantage there, but they know everybody else is 6 months or a year behind. So now they want to use it and they want to, you know, get their surprise. And so you can imagine this almost an arms race in science and technology, not specifically because we're all competing just in AI with AI, but because we're using these capabilities to try to multiply other kinds of science and technology within the hybrid threats kind of space.
No, that's great. Kelsey, what matters more in today's strategic competition, resources or the speed of adaptation? And maybe I'm thinking about, you know, resilience, iterative learning, adaptation, but you pull it from where you're thinking.
Resources are great to have, but the speed of adaptation is both the risk and the advantage. And I live in a region where we've never had enough resources, and we'll probably complain about it arguably into the future. That will just always be the case. But can we use the newest technology to kind of leapfrog over a situation that, you know, we might not be able to integrate? We've had lots of leapfrog moments in the Arctic where we go from lack of land-based internet to suddenly we have sat-based comms. It's like, well, that's fine. I don't need a landline if I have a satellite phone, not a problem. And so I'm waiting for the emergence of that AI leapfrog in the Arctic, because it's a region that historically is looking for an innovative method, not only to keep pace with the rest of the globe, but just because the environment demands it. So I'm starting to see, you know, little peaks here. We're using and integrating AI in some of our indigenous corporations and groups within the region. They're using it for, you know, domain awareness and environmental monitoring, but I can see how that could be leveraged in other spaces. So, yeah.
Oh, nice. Nate, from the governance perspective, can institutions built for stability adapt fast enough?
I think they can. I think it's just a question of will they? I mean, when I think about this, at least kind of looking at Africa, what's I think happened, especially over the past 20 or 30 years, is you now have a pretty broad divergence in government capacity. You know, some countries, Morocco, Nigeria, Kenya, Egypt have pretty sophisticated technological ecosystems, indigenous defense industrial bases, are always kind of at the front of the pack when it comes to kind of releasing new AI strategies, policies, norms, or ethics. Nigeria, for example, just kind of purchased an AI command and control system from a vendor in the UK. And then you have countries, I'm not going to name particular names, who are just as kind of problematic and just as kind of mired in conflict and just as incapable now as they've been for the past 20 or 30 years. I mean, I think to the point some of my earlier colleagues have made, I think one of the things that ironically happens in a world of technology is actually it puts a premium on human intelligence, judgment, and decision-making more rather than less, you know. So and that means that it's whoever is able to outcompete other entities, organizations, when it comes to governance is gonna be successful, and those who aren't, right?
Yeah. So let me pull real quickly for a round the horn, real quick response on this. And so if technology is, I mean, it is advancing faster than institutions typically adapt. At least that's my proposition. And so if you could give governments one priority for adapting to this new environment, what would it be? Go ahead, Inez, and then say, we'll go.
I think it's education. We've neglected our science and technology. We're trying to get better, but we're falling woefully behind. We need a different type of education because it's physics now, that those types of science that we need, not computer science like it was before. We'll continue to need the STEM areas, but it's a more complex world. So we need a higher education that's able to cope with that. Over.
Higher education it is. Say, what do you got?
All right. Well, you know, the three-legged stool of technology, people, and processes. So Inez just said people. So I'll say processes, but I agree with her too. So you need all three. And so we need institutional processes that allow people to experiment, that allow for safe failures, and that really push down this kind of requirements for adaptation, for innovation, and push up, you know, good information in ways that allow our organizations to be more agile. If you look at what the Ukrainians have done with how that they've really changed their institutions, not just their people, to be more rapid and adaptive, that's something not to copy paste. We can't do that exactly, but we can find ways to make processes so that our very skilled people through the educational methods that Inez mentioned can then be empowered to actually make change.
Processes it is. Kelsey, over to you. Bring in.
I like the processes part, and I might go down the track of we need better alliance between government and industry. And we waffle back and forth in our country between, is the government going to take the lead? Is industry going to take the lead? And we just keep kind of ping-ponging back and forth. And the challenge is that industry has a unique perspective in what they're chasing down. So if they're building our AI models, they're doing it for profit. That's their incentive to come to work every day. And government is doing it because we're here to defend the United States and defend the homeland. And so we need these two systems to work together in a better manner so that either side understands that when the next tool is developed, when the next phase of computing is developed, we're doing so in a way that benefits the general population and isn't to our detriment.
Okay, Nate, one government priority.
Thanks. I'm going to actually try to bridge the difference between Say and Inez and say, I think we need to invest in technology strategists. people who deeply understand the technology, but also understand policy and strategy to enable us to think creatively and strategically about A, what the implications of emerging technologies from AI to nanotechnology to space to biotech is, and then think really about how to strategically leverage those technologies to our advantages without, I think, being nearly as I think beholden to the past as a lot of particularly social scientists are. I think that I find that as a big challenge as a social scientist is like we basically use the past to predict the future. And when it comes to new technology, that is a very, very dangerous game to play.
Let's go to another segment. I want to talk about governance and deterrence and, you know, can competition be managed? And so I think we've discussed who adapts fastest, but adaptation alone, I mean, it doesn't preserve stability. So the larger question is whether technology can be governed in ways that reduce risk and prevent conflict. So Nate, traditional deterrence relies on capability, credibility, communication. So if technology is compressing decision timelines and increasing uncertainty, like we spoke about, what does effective deterrence look like in the future? What do you think?
It's a really tough question. It's a little bit out of my like, as like a scholar of African politics, we don't usually think in terms of like credibility and deterrence and those things like that. So I'll give it my best shot. I mean, I think that we don't necessarily need humans in the loop of every decision, but I think we need to have humans that understand enough of what the technology is doing that we can still be able to both communicate with one another. We need, I think, common tools, techniques, and practices, and communicate effectively with our adversaries. So I think going back to kind of what I think has been a theme of this conversation, insofar as we can ensure that despite the fact that we're living in an environment where much of what we're going to be doing is completely increasingly automated, we need to develop mechanisms that will enable us to foster trust in our technology, trust in the human beings that are operating. And even if we can't necessarily fully trust our adversaries, ways to understand their signals and intentions in a much more fluid and complicated environment.
Thanks, Nate. So effective deterrence in the future. Inez, say, what do you think? Inez?
So for me, in the cyber world, it's deterrence by denial. And you see how Cybercom has pivoted from 2018, where they do the persistent engagement. Similarly, DISA, which created the DCDC, the Defense Cyber Defense Command, and they're moving towards, they've already moved towards implementing zero trust and also proactive network campaigning, where they're treating the DISA network or the defense network as a weapon system. And that's how they're protecting it, where they're engaging with the enemy within the network. So that's my take.
Deterrence by denial. Say?
Well, I'll agree with that, but I'll add to that we also probably need, I don't know if deterrence is the right word, but we also need escalation where appropriate. We're really in currently, we are currently in a hybrid war, right? We are currently across Western allies, across all of our areas of responsibility, experiencing hybrid operations. And we need to have new methods of military strategy, I think, for the kind of era that we're in. So traditional concepts of deterrence when you're talking about like a Cold War nuclear era are just not the same now when you have all of these non-state actors and state actors and cyber attacks and sabotage and things that are below the threshold of war and cognitive attacks all happening simultaneously. So my challenge would be not what does deterrence look like in the current era, but what is the new set of military strategic tools that we should really be talking about? And maybe it's not the same conventional ones we've had in the past. I think discussions like this are a good way to start to add a plus one to what Nate said. I do think we need technology strategists working with military strategists to think about what the overall organizational design looks like in this new era.
So Inez, say throughout the escalation word, so is strategic escalation becoming harder to control?
It is, because you can't see it. That's the biggest problem for in the cyber world and the space any of these domains that are non-traditional is difficult to see. If you can't see it, escalation, I think, goes up. But then, you know, over to the experts here in the group who might have a different perspective.
Sounds a lot like lawfare and counter-lawfare. If we don't have the regulations that can keep up with what is a threat and what is a crime and what is, what are the rules? Do we have a common set of rules that we're operating from? I would argue we don't in many cases, especially in terms of what AI is advancing. And so how can you deter an adversary if there's not a rule that you've put forth that actually matches up with the pace of technology? And that's the struggle that we have frequently. There's a new tool out there. Do we know how to thwart it? Do we know if we can thwart it? UAV systems are primary. I would love to be able to fly military UAV systems over the Arctic region to monitor the domain. That's illegal in our country. We can't do that. We're not from a military perspective. We can talk about a community-based monitoring program, but if an adversary can come into our airspace and do that same thing, what are we doing? And those are physical systems we can see. What about the systems that Inez is talking about where you can't physically see it, you just feel the effects?
Okay, so I'm going to send this next one to Say, and then Nate, if you'd respond as well. So, I mean, so if competition cannot be eliminated, how can it be managed responsibly? Or maybe if I stated differently, you know, what norms, guardrails, or partnerships matter most then? Say, then Nate.
Oh, gosh. I mean, that's a great question, but I'm not sure that I know the answer. What norms and partnerships matter the most? I definitely feel strongly that when we talk about military and national alliances, those are absolutely critical. There's tons of research that shows that you are gaining a lot of bang for your buck through international interoperability with allies. And then as, who is it that said it? Kelsey, I think, that talking about the public-private partnerships, about where we really need this whole of society, comprehensive security approach, where we're seeing public, private, NGOs, academia, all working towards similar kinds of security goals. So I don't know that there's a single answer right this second, but that kind of cohesion is essential. And that's also what's being degraded right now in our degrading cognitive domain. So just putting it out there, high risk.
No, you're absolutely right, Nate.
So Say also already hit on the topic of public-private partnerships, which is something I was going to hit on. So I'm actually going to, I think there's a concept in cybersecurity called resilience, where I think the world we're moving in, especially where we're living in a hybrid environment, I think this could also potentially be applied to prevention of war. I think we need to be able to take a hit, either a cyber attack, a communications network that gets knocked out, a casualty, and we need to be prepared for it. We need to be able to move on. We need to be able to say, okay, what's next? I think one of the dangers I see in the current information age, I think in some ways, a lack of trust has caused society to become very, very brittle. And kind of any kind of like setback is seen as an opportunity to kind of cast aspersions against whatever party, whatever faction, whatever leader, rather than coming together and saying, okay, this is what we expect. I mean, this is the world we're living in now, where there's just a lot of complexity and a lot of different ways that somebody can harm somebody else, from a cyber attack to an assassination to a drone attack. And I think thinking more in terms of how do we foster resilient people, resilient processes, and resilient technologies, to kind of highlight and underscore what Shay said, is going to be essential to effectively competing in all domains for the coming era.
Let's go to this last segment I want to talk, and that's the looking ahead. I mean, what comes next? So we spent much of this discussion examining today's challenges, I mean, from governance and resilience, even to competition and deterrence. But what comes next? I mean, so if you look, and I want to go around the panel quickly, but looking ahead to, let's say, 2030, what emerging technologies or combination of technologies is most likely to reshape the security within your region? So Nate, Kelsey, Inez, Say. Nate.
I mean, I think for me, it's unmanned systems. far and away are really the one, because, you know, there are a lot of wars in Africa, and I think, you know, we're seeing, I think, over 37 African countries, every major armed non-state group has adapted unmanned systems. When we're talking about countries who kind of prior to 10 or 15 years ago didn't even really have, they had air forces that existed on paper. So just the reach of both a state and armed state non-actors is fundamentally transforming it. And I think in every conflict, every country, every state is in the middle of trying to grapple with this shift. In no small part because with a lack of air power, there's also been a lack of air defenses. So especially now for 2030, I think that is going to be the single biggest technological shift that all states in the region are in one way or another going to be dealing with.
Yeah, well said, Kelsey.
So I'm going to tell you that it's quantum computing, and the reason that it's quantum computing is because we are looking at zero trust architecture. And how do we trust the information coming in, and how do we trust the information going out? And so if we can get quantum computing to a level that can be integrated into more of our systems, something that is well beyond the theoretical into the practical, jumping over the huge chasm that requires, then we're going to be able to solve maybe one of the issues we've talked about today. So I think as a society, as we have come to this communal realization that the technology is scary and does scary things, we're going to have a push more toward how do we trust so that we can go back to really a better societal environment. And that's what I'm putting my money on.
Okay, I know.
I'm the same quantum, but in a negative aspect, the adversaries have stolen our data, and now they're going to be able to decrypt it. So they'll have a better operational perspective of how we operate and information about us. Number two is quantum communication, in particular, because I believe that that's going to be one of the ways that we could secure things for the military aspects, but also it's going to be a way to guarantee that the through space, through other systems that are already built right now, China's already demonstrated it can be done. It will be a problem in the future. So, over.
Okay, say.
All right, so I'm going to cheat a little bit. So I'm going to say the biggest disruption in the next, 5 to 10 years is going to be AI plus fill in the blank. AI plus quantum, AI plus synthetic biology, AI plus neurotechnology, and the creative application of that convergence. So what we see already right now is different militaries, non-state actors using generative AI, and particularly in the larger militaries, we're seeing it bolt on to existing processes, like we've already talked about, right? So you have your existing process, you stick some AI into it, and like, it's kind of mid. But I think if we're creatively using AI plus some of these other technologies, it's going to create surprise. It's going to create crazy distortions and complexity. And I think that's going to be the most disruptive thing.
One final question here on this segment. I'm going to go with Inez first. I mean, really, it feels like we're living through a period of this continuous disruption. So, is AI making the security environment more unstable, or can it help societies better manage uncertainty? What do you think, Inez?
More unstable by far.
More
And
unstable.
yes, and I'm not sure how we can cope with it. Of course, I'm looking at it from the negative perspective and security. It can bring capabilities that we never had before, better health, better, you name it. But I think we're going to be suffering from many of the adverse effects over.
Kelsey.
I want to agree with Inez, but I also want to offer up that it is coming from someone who is firmly in midlife. So when I look to the generations younger than me, their frustration with what we have developed is going to change that dynamic a little bit. I'm looking at my son who will be able to vote in the next presidential election, and his use or lack thereof of technology. And I'm going, interesting. Curious to see how this will play out.
Nate.
Sorry, what was the, I didn't catch the question.
Oh no, just asking about as we look to the future here, whether or
Oh,
not.
sorry. Oh, we're still on the future technologies.
Whether or not AI, whether this technology is going to make us better or make us more fragile.
Honestly, I have no idea. I think that's one of the fun things about being a human being is that we make choices, and the choices has consequences, and there are a lot of choices that I think every actor is going to be responsible for figuring out whether our technology ultimately makes us better or worse. I think maybe, you know, to be a little more nuanced, maybe both at the same time. I think that's kind of been the legacy of every technology going back, you know, hundreds of years, from, you know, the electric power to, you know, nuclear energy and nuclear weapons. It just changes us at the same time as like posing new challenges and makes us both better and both worse. Hopefully we can keep it together so that we're still around in the next 50 or 100 years. But yeah, I think that's the best I can do.
I'm going to take us to a couple of audience questions that were submitted at registration. The first one's asking about middle powers. How can middle powers remain competitive and help preserve regional stability in an era of AI-driven great power rivalry? Middle powers. Say, would you like to start there?
Well, okay. I mean, I can try. This is probably a good question for people who are working a bit more in international security strategy on the political side. But I would say that what we're seeing here, the different kinds of emerging technologies don't necessarily benefit these large state actors solely. I mean, you already see very small groups, non-state actors, being able to gain quite a bit of advantage. That said, if you're not trying to go through one of those like innovative, disruptive kind of approaches, it's all about partnership, right? And so collaborating, creating interoperability. And every nation has unique capabilities that they can contribute. A good example is what Finland is doing, right? So Finland has a comprehensive security program that has really become a model across a lot of NATO nations about how you get a whole of society, a total defense approach. And, you know, that country has what, maybe 6 million, 7 million people. And so I think it's less about the specific size. It's more about the partnership. It's more about the innovation. And it's more about leveraging the strengths you have.
Nice. Inez, on allies and partners, how do we ensure AI strengthens alliances rather than widens capability gaps among its partners?
I think we need to have more dialogue between different countries. I think we need to come up with common standards that we agree to in the perspective of, I deal with the military. So how do we get countries to understand each other and work together to build processes that can leverage these technologies in order so that they're interoperable and beneficial for everyone? Over.
Last question's open to the floor. It's on preparing leaders. What should military and civilian education do differently to prepare leaders for the AI era? Jump in.
Ask questions. Be creative.
Okay. We need to leverage a learning engineering approach. Talking about standards, that's a new standard for, I'm going to say instructional design, but it's more than that. It's really a rethinking about how we do education, training, and human performance support. And so we need to rethink those systems so that we can be more effective and efficient at our training, education, and preparation.
Wonderful. Nate, you're going to say. Go ahead, Inez. You're talking. Go ahead. You got it. And then Nate, close us up.
I think you need to bring in the private sector, not be afraid to have the conversations that we tend to do. We bring them in after when we want to regulate them. We need to bring them in before, and we need to have ongoing conversations. Over.
Wonderful. Nate.
I would say, I think at least until something drastically changes, which it could in a year or 50, we need to make sure that we combine AI with human expertise. I think AI is used most effectively in conjunction with human expertise, which also is making sure that we have well-trained human experts that aren't always kind of offloading their cognitive loads onto AI if they're going to be losing it. I mean, there have been studies that have come out that have shown that programmers who rely too much on AI are kind of losing some of those basic programming skills. So I think we're all going to have to grapple with the question of, you know, how do we keep our minds sharp in an era where a lot of what we do cognitively can be done by artificial intelligence. So I think we need to train our leaders to think about AI in terms of how it stimulates and broadens their minds rather than necessarily substituting for original, you know, thinking and thought processes that I think are still very, very much needed by human beings. I mean, there's still so much. I think, you know, as I've alluded to earlier, I think the demand for accomplished experts in a world where AI is everywhere is, I think, actually going to increase rather than decrease. And so we need to make sure that we are training that next generation of experts who understand the vulnerabilities and strengths of AI systems.
Nate, Kelsey, Inez, say thank you for being on Dialogue. Appreciate it. As we conclude today's episode, this conversation reminds us that the greatest challenges of emerging technologies may not be the technologies themselves, but how quickly governments, institutions, and societies can adapt to them. My thanks to Dr. Nate Allen, Dr. Kelsey Fraser, Dr. Say Schatz, and Dr. Inez Miyamoto for sharing their insights and perspectives. On behalf of all of us at DKI APCSS, thank you for joining us. I'm James Minnick. Until we meet again, aloha oi. The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government.